Okay, who are you and why are you here?
I'm Mark Norstad of Paragon Machine Works, and our customers are here at the bike show, so we want to show off our stuff to our customers.
Well, you show up at a lot of shows. Almost anywhere you could look, you show up, and it's great, and you really rep your products, but you also work really hard to make them.
Well, yeah, we do, and that's, anyone who's self-employed is going to work really hard if they're really serious about it. And we really do have a commitment to bicycles. I mean, I grew up riding bikes and having fun on bikes. I also grew up doing mechanical stuff and doing machine work. So it's pretty easy for me to put in that kind of hard work because I love it.
Yeah. You're totally one of the hard work crowd.
right.
I'm one of the lazy guy crowd.
Okay.
So we've known each other for a long time, and we've been in different spheres and different locales. But, you know, me being in Marin, and you've been there forever and with the bike scene, can you kind of, I mean, it would be nice for other people to hear, how did you sort of enter both your love of bicycles and bicycle parts and also your love of metalcraft?
Well, the bicycle thing started when I got my first bike. I just liked riding my bike. It was
When was that?
Third grade.
Okay.
And it was a Montgomery Ward's 26-inch middleweight cruiser, and it was way too big for me. I could barely fit on it, but I rode it. And then probably about eighth grade or so, I cut it all apart because I wanted to do something with it.
Like you cut it apart at the joints and stuff?
Yeah, right, exactly. And I had zero welding skills, and I tried playing around with bolting stuff together, and I just didn't have the skills.
Did anybody in your family or anybody around you have skills like that?
No, nobody did. So that was like eighth grade. The next year I went into high school, and our high school fortunately had a machine shop.
Where was that?
That was at Redwood High School, Larkspur, California. So the whole machine shop was really good, and I think one of the best things about the machine shop, I got to give credit to our teacher, a guy named Ben Bolt, who was very enthusiastic about metalwork and teaching it to the kids as a craft and as a career too. So we had
That was a different time. That was late 60s or mid 70s?
Mid 70s basically.
Right.
Yeah,
so that would be a concept, whereas nowadays that's not really a thing.
Well, right. It would be a normal thing to train a kid to be a machinist, and that's, I don't think that happens anymore these days.
No, it doesn't.
You know? So I also took math classes, which were helpful. Geometry was great. Mechanical drawing classes. All those classes came together to give me a lot of the skills that I have now to do that. And all during this time when I was in high school and doing machine shop, I was messing around with bikes. And we had graduated or sunk, I'm not sure which it is, but going down to 20-inch wheel bikes, which were the ancestors of BMX bikes, where we took Stingrays and ditched the banana seat and put a normal saddle on it. We spoked up the Schwinn S2 or S7, the fatter rim on the front, so we could run 2 1/8-inch tires front and rear, knobbies, you know, and we went off-road with them, and that was a lot of fun.
What kind of off-road, like building jumps or just messing around, or are you going to some place to get drunk?
No, we're way too young to get drunk. This is on single tracks and fire roads in Marin County, in the hills in Corte Madera where we live. And it was just a lot of fun. And then later on, we saw some of the older kids at high school were riding 26-inch wheel bikes. And those were, again, the precursors to mountain bikes. And these guys were taking old...
Just clunker guys.
But they're bikes that they had found at the dump. And the first thing you do is you take the tank off, you take the fenders off, you take the chain guard off, you'd go and get knobby tires. If you could afford it, you'd spoke up some heavier wheels. And then we just ride them off-road in the dirt, again, on fire roads, the few single tracks we could find, and it was a lot of fun.
I'm a Marin guy now. Was single track different then in terms of the number or where they were? Is there more now, or is it just they were the same, just more rugged then or
something? Well, it was different because there were less of them. There are less people in Marin County and almost no one riding bikes on them. So when you came across a hiker on a single track, they just said, oh, aren't you guys clever riding a bike on a single track? You know, and nowadays, you know, they would like to kill you. But
it's different.
It is very, very different. And the other thing that happened, too, was it was normal to find a buddy who had a pickup truck and do a run up Mount Tam with all the bikes in the back and then simply go downhill. And that was one of the things I always kind of wanted to earn my altitude, and one of the first things I did was put
you're crazy.
I know I'm crazy. I actually put much lower gears on my cruiser so I could actually ride up the hill, and everyone said my bike was stupid because I couldn't go fast enough downhill because it was only a single speed and I'd spin out going downhill. But I could actually...
Were you using rim brakes or hub brakes?
Hub brakes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just one coaster brake, you know. Mm-hmm. And as always, the Moro was the best. And I, as a kid, I never found a Moro. So I was always riding on Bendixes, which were good. They're okay.
Sure.
But anyway, so that sort of, you know, bicycle thing happened, you know, really in high school because I had the tools to be able to work on my bike. And in high school, I was always modifying my cruisers or my 20-inch bikes or doing something to make them a little bit better or a little bit different than what everyone else is riding.
Were you primarily looking at performance, or were you looking at some beautification,
no,
aesthetic stuff too?
Purely durability, because the old bikes are, you know, they're just mild steel, and they're clunkers, they're clunky, they're heavy, they're, you know.
I've bent a few mild steel bikes.
Right, exactly, yeah, and, you know, and the Schwinn steel rims were heavy, they're strong, but they're still really easy to bend. You know, if you hit a rock hard, they'd bend. The only thing you had to worry about was whether or not the tire still fit on the rim, because no one had rim brakes. It didn't matter. You know, you all had coaster brakes. But yeah, it was purely to make the bike.
What's nice is we've come full circle.
We have,
so
right.
I don't even true rims straight anymore because it doesn't matter.
Well, right, exactly. Or the carbon fiber and they crack and you have to get a new one. But the whole idea was longevity and performance. That was the idea. You know, I never cared what my bikes looked like. I never painted any of them. It was just to build a better bike. You know, that was the idea.
Okay. So this is in high school still, or
right,
post high school?
That was high school. And then post high school, again, fortunately, the local junior college, which is College of Marin, had a machine shop program. And I really still liked machine work.
Were they in Kentfield for that, or had they had the IVC?
That was Kentfield. And again, a really great teacher there, a guy named Ray Matoza, really enthusiastic. And there were required projects you were supposed to do, and I was always able to talk Ray into letting me do something else that was bicycle related. And actually, as a little aside there, when I started, Joe Breeze was in the class ahead of me working on his first batch of bikes. So that was when I first ran into Joe and sort of was aware that I wasn't doing all the stuff in a vacuum. There are other people who are enthusiastic about bikes.
Was Joe building like real road bikes with real lugs and tubes?
No, that was his very first batch of 10, you know, bilateral frames.
Sure.
He's working on them then.
Okay.
So that's the time that was. And again, Ray was really helpful and willing to let us work on projects that were our own projects, our own bicycle stuff, as long as they sort of fulfilled the requirements. We had to do a thread on a lathe, and we had to mill a keyway on a mill, and, you know, learn all this sort of basic machine shop stuff.
Well, when I have students at my shop, anytime I can have them connecting with their passion,
right,
they get 8 times more learning out of it than they're ever going to get because they give a shit.
Right, exactly. And that was exactly the same with me. I really cared about what I wanted to do, and I wanted to make this stuff so I could go out and ride and kind of show it off and say, look at what I've done. Look at what I can do. And it's always been fun.
You were proving yourself, like, amongst the guys.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, so after College of Marin, I ended up getting a job in a machine shop. It was a production machine shop, some early CNC stuff, and I learned CNC work there.
Where in the Bay?
It was called CNK Precision Machining, and they were in Novato.
Okay.
And eventually moved to Petaluma and another small world thing. That's the shop now that White Industries is in. So that kind of came full circle, too.
That's cool.
So I did the machine work for 3.5 years and again, really enjoyed it, doing production stuff, learned a lot. And really had a good time. And after,
I think that's important for people that like are into it. And, you know, I'm into it too. Mm-hmm. Different levels, obviously.
Right,
I'm lazier.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, those first learning experiences, because to get through metalcraft, it's really hard work.
Right.
And you have a lot of learning to do.
Yeah.
And if you're not in the right environment, you don't learn the lessons. You don't learn how to do it right or well.
Right.
But if you're in the right environment, you work really hard, but you learn the fundamentals so that later you continue, you know how to do
right.
it. And all.
Right. Those fundamentals are there. And again, I got to give credit to my teachers. Those guys really had a passion for it, as well as I had a passion for it, too. But I took 4 years of machine shop in high school and then 2 years in junior college. I learned more in 2 years in junior college than I had in the previous four. And again, when I worked doing it as a living, day in and day out, 40 hours a week, I learned more in that 3.5 years than I had in the previous 6 years of high school and junior college. So the more I did it, the more I learned, and I'm still learning. You know, there's still new stuff that I can learn, and I love that part of it. But after working in production machining for a while, I decided I wanted to do something else, and I had no idea what I wanted.
Were you biking with the boys then still, or were you just kind of working?
I was just kind of working, yeah. One of the bad things about getting old enough to get a driver's license is the bikes kind of fell by the wayside for a while, and I really got into cars a lot. You know, and again, I did a lot of machine work on the cars. It was a lot of fun.
Were you hot rodding type of stuff?
Hot rod American V8s. Yeah.
Okay. So, aside from bikes, has that been a distraction for you, or did you just kind of, that was a passing phase?
It was a passing phase. You know, I was very, very enthusiastic about it, to the point of actually taking my car and racing it on a drag strip.
Up at Sears Point
and the old drag strip that's in the East Bay. I forget the name of it. Fremont Dragway.
You never got pulled in with motocross bikes or anything?
No, never got into that. But
so you've done production work.
Production work, right. So I went back. Went back to the junior college, and going back to the junior college was really fun because I wasn't working towards a degree, and I just took classes I wanted to take. I took French for 4 years, which I've totally lost that, but that was fine. But I took art classes. I took every art class I could. I took drawing. I took figure drawing. I took sculpture. I took ceramics. I took jewelry.
You kind of realized you weren't very well rounded, and you kind of wanted to fill in some gaps.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Or you were trying to meet girls.
Well, yeah, that too. Yeah. You know, in any college campus, you'll find a lot of attractive young ladies, and that's a draw for sure. But the art classes gave me sort of a feeling for how things should look. You know, and there's a composition that happens not only on a painting. A painter worries about the composition of how his figures work within the frame of the painting. And sculptors do the same thing, but how the composition works in the frame of a 3D thing. And the same thing happens with the bike parts I do. They are a composition, and they do have to fit within the confines of a frame. And they essentially connect the dots. You on a dropout, you want to connect the axle and you want to connect the frame tubes, and if it's a disc brake, the brake caliper. So that part's really simple, but connecting the dots in a way that looks nice and is attractive to the consumer, and is it not only is attractive enough so someone say, I want to spend my money on that, and that's what it comes down to. Make it look good enough so that someone feels really good about spending a lot of money on this stuff.
You know, I want to talk a lot more about what you're talking about right now, but I want to get us back to where you are in college learning art, and then where do you go next?
Okay,
we're going to talk a lot about what you're just talking about.
So finished up. So I took art classes, and again, I had taken every single art class that was available, and you know, I was kind of at a loose end. There are no more art classes to take. And I briefly.
Did you do photography too, or just drawing?
No, never did photography. Right. Yeah. So let's see. Where did I go on that one? So. I was done and kind of at a loose end, and I briefly considered engineering and going back to school and doing engineering. And I looked at what the starting wages were of a mechanical engineer, and the starting wages were less than I'd been making as a machinist. I thought, well, that's kind of silly to go to school for all that time.
Times have changed.
And end up making less money. Right, exactly. So I was kind of at a loose end. My father was an architect, and he was building a new building for his business, and he needed people to help him build the building. So my two brothers, my brother-in-law, and I essentially built the building that my father designed, and his business was in there. That took us about a year, and incidentally, that's the building I'm in now for the machine shop.
Where you are in Richmond,
Designed by your father, built by me and my brothers.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I had no idea. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. It's such a weird little compound there, and it's a great spot in a weird part of Richmond.
Yeah, and we're really happy we were able to get that. It's an amazing place. It's really good.
That is hilarious. Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, so I worked in construction for a year, and we did all phases of the construction, from the foundation to the roof, the electrical, the plumbing, every last bit of it. And when that was over, you know, again, I was at a loose end, and I went back to visit my old boss at C&K Precision Machining. And, you know, he was very friendly and very nice. And he said, you know, why don't you start your own machine shop? And I said, well, I had never even considered that. I never even knew that I was capable of doing that. You know, I don't know how to run a business. I'm a machinist, but I'm not a business guy. And he said, well, it's really not that hard. You're a smart guy. You can do it. And I'll send some customers your way.
So, oh, well, that's the magic right there, right. Customers.
So, yeah. So on the strength of that, I went out and borrowed some money for the down payment on some machinery from my grandmother and my brother and rounded up the 20% down payment they wanted, bought a brand new Bridgeport and a brand new lathe.
Brand new machine tools.
Brand new machines. And my and the thinking
you got balls.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was kind of a ballsy move. But the thinking was, if I'm serious about doing this, I can't do it with half-ass equipment. I've got to have decent equipment. I've got to have equipment that's going to hold tolerances and is going to be really reliable for me. And worst case scenario, I figured if I totally fail at running a machine shop, I can always get a job and still make my payments. You know, the payments weren't that bad. I could still make them. So I got a lathe and a mill, and I went out for one day, local in Marin County, and talked to people who were interested in machine work, and talked to my old boss, gave me some leads, and I talked to those people, and that was the last day I ever went out looking for work.
Wow.
Yeah, from that point on.
If I could do that, yeah. Boy, I would have owned my own machine shop a long time ago.
Right. So,
I'm the world's worst salesman. I don't think I could convince anybody to want to hire me.
I'm horrible at sales, too. That's definitely not one of my strong points. But the work came in, and I started it in my folks' basement, so the overhead was really, really low. And then within 9 months, Eric Koski, who was building Trailmaster Bikes, and I had been doing work for them as well, doing dropouts for the Trailmaster Forks.
They were over in Sausalito?
In Tiburon.
Tiburon, right, sorry.
Yeah, at the Cove Shopping Center. So Eric Koski convinced me to move into a genuine industrial space. And we shared that space for a year and a half or 2 years. And eventually I got to the point where I needed more space and Eric was rarely ever there. And I said, look, Eric, how about I just take over the space? And
where were you at that
shop? This is in Greenbrae, near Larkspur on an industrial way.
So that old flooding shop you had?
The old flooding shop.
Damn, that place was ghetto.
Yeah, it was a great place too. So that was like a 1,000-square-foot shop.
And I was amazed you even got moved out of there. I don't even know how you got stuff in, but I don't know how you got it out either.
Yeah. So that 1,000-square-foot shop, we had the original lathe and mill and two CNC mills at that time and a CNC lathe. So we had those all crammed in there. And business was going really well. Things were going great. And
who were your main customers around that time? Like what kind of work were you doing? Bikes and outside of bikes.
It was bike stuff. Outside of bike stuff, we did have a customer that did medical equipment. I mean, the stuff we did was the mechanical stuff. None of it ever went in a human body or anything like that. That was bike stuff. We were doing bike stuff at the time.
Were you sort of supplying like all the guys that were like say maybe Richie or Breeze
stuff? It was none of those guys. One of the sort of chances, one of my many lucky events. This guy named Gary Helfrick called me up, and Gary was one of the founders of Merlin Metalworks, and he had gotten out of Merlin Metalworks, and one of the things he did was sign a 2-year non-competition agreement. So he moved to the West Coast, and he was connected with Ibis Cycles and bicycling in general. And when his non-competition agreement was up, the first thing he did was go out and sought out people to make titanium components for him. And at the time, all I had was a lathe. I didn't have any mills at the time.
Had you worked with Ty by then, or was that your introduction?
I'd worked with titanium at my other machine shop, so I'd had some experience with it. It's a great material to work with. I really like it a lot. So Gary called me up and said, can you make, you know, this and that and that? And it's like, yeah, we can do it. And so I started making parts, you know, in batches of 10 or 20 for Gary in titanium. And the bike world is very small, is even smaller then. So the word of mouth got out that there was this guy in this machine shop in California making titanium frame building parts. So I got calls from other builders.
I worked at Fat City back in the early 90s, and you were one of the main suppliers at that time.
I mean, we did bottom brackets for Fat City. We ultimately did their 10th anniversary dropouts and a bunch of just parts.
Well, you also had like the beautiful brake posts at the time compared to anything else you could buy. Yours were awesome.
Thanks. So the word of mouth got out that I was doing titanium frame building stuff, and like Daryl Funk was one of my early customers. Clark Kent was another one. I mean, they're gone now. I mean, they actually got, there's a file cabinet I have of jobs that we've done, and there's this record of all these frame building companies that are no longer around. Sure. But some of them survived. When the word of mouth did get around, people started calling me, and they said, you know, again, can you make this? Of course, yeah, we can make that and make that. And it eventually evolved to the point where I was able to have kind of a stock catalog of parts. And the stock catalog was one typewritten sheet that I typed up myself and went to the copy shop and had 50 copies made, and then went to the bike show, to Interbike. And stood in a little booth and handed the stuff out, and it was completely the wrong show because it's for dealers. You know, it's not for builders or suppliers. But it was the only bike show around at the time. You know?
Right, so, a handmade bike show wasn't even a dream at that time.
Right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So again, you know, it spread the word, and we put a little ad in some little tiny magazines that were around then. And people would send a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'd send them the catalog back, and then people would call on the phone. And we'd send stuff out COD. You know, we didn't do any credit card stuff then, or we just sent stuff.
And that was probably a very wise move too.
Yeah, exactly. So it just kind of.
In fact, I think I remember some CODs that there was some desperate running around because
We got to pay this.
Yeah, we got to pay it, or we're not going to have bikes and all that stuff.
Yeah. So it just kept on growing, and eventually it got to the point where the business was successful enough that I actually decided to take some time off. And I decided I was going to go to New Zealand, and I was going to do a bike tour of New Zealand. I wasn't sure if I was going to do the North or the South Island, but I was going to go.
Just road touring type of thing?
Yeah, So I walked out of my shop one morning to go down to the travel agent, because there was no internet to book your flights on, and my landlady was there. And she said, oh, by the way, the guy in the end in the other shop is moving out. Are you interested in that space? Said, well, let's take a look at it. And it was 2,700 square feet, so it was almost three times the size I had. And I went in there and I said, I'll take it. I want to move in here. And that was the end of the trip to New Zealand. Yeah. That never happened. So whatever money I had saved to go traveling went to this move into this bigger shop. And moving into the bigger shop allowed me to buy more machinery, which I instantly did, and filled up that space. And that just kept the business growing. And the whole hand-built bike thing is kind of this, you know, being in the right place at the right time. Where I was doing machine work, I was into bikes, and this whole hand-built thing sort of took off.
And it took off primarily, or not primarily, but there was the Bay Area was kind of an epicenter at the time where suddenly people had a need to make bikes.
Right.
Versus
yeah.
if you were in another part of the country or whatever, mountain biking wasn't even a concept. You could buy a bike.
Right.
But you couldn't buy a mountain bike.
You couldn't buy a mountain bike, and that's exactly what drove my business, because frame builders like Fat City and a bunch of other ones all over the country popped up who are addressing this market for mountain bikes. People wanted mountain bikes. The commercially available ones were not so good, or they weren't that available, or again, people like to buy a custom-made local product. So we, you know, as the hand-built bike business grew, we just kept making more and more and more parts. And it started out in titanium because there was really nothing available in titanium at all. And then people looked at our titanium stuff and said, well, can you make that in steel? And I was like, yeah, of course, it's easy to do. So we started making steel stuff. And then stainless steel came along a few years ago, and it's the same thing.
I was introduced to it, there was still a lot of Campy product being used for frame building,
right.
Campy or Sinelli type of part,
right.
And that sort of phased out, and there wasn't any more cast parts came out of vogue.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the other sort of revolution that happened in there, you know, being in the right place at the right time, was that CNC machinery became, you know, reasonably affordable. It used to be that a CNC mill would take up a whole room, and the computer would take up another room.
And you weren't going to buy it unless you were a military contractor.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know. So when the price of the equipment came down low enough, the price of entry was much, much less.
So a lot of things were really converging just at the right time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you were a hard worker.
And I was a hard worker. Right. I guess.
I mean, I've noticed that people that work hard seem to get really lucky.
there may just be a connection there. So it just kept growing, and then later on, this is in 2007, so not that long ago, My father retired, and he had sold his business to a guy who was really not doing very well with the business, and he couldn't pay the rent on the building, or it was very sporadic. And at one point, I was sitting down at dinner with my folks, and my dad said, you know, if I could just find someone to sell that business to, I'd sell it right now. And I said, well, raise my hand. It's like, hey, Dad, you know, let's talk. So we worked out a deal where my parents financed it. Again, it's a really, you know, lucky thing that I had parents in a position to be able to do that. But I was able to pay them more interest than they could get at a bank, and I was paying less interest, and it worked out well for both of us. And we moved into that building.
What were you considering? I mean, just speaking purely as a local, what were your considerations of now you're crossing the bridge? Because you live in Corte Madera.
In Corte Madera, right.
And so, now you're going to be crossing the bridge,
right.
going through a toll, and you're going to go through a very different area.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And what were you thinking at that time, just in terms of that?
Well, it was one of those things where that's the price I'm going to have to pay, because the buying the building in Richmond, I was able to buy the building, get two and a half times as much space, and still pay the same amount of money. You know, so it's like, so from financially, it's like, okay, this is a no-brainer. I'd be an idiot not to do it. And moving out of the floodplain, too. Yeah. That was really good.
Yeah, the flooding of your old shop is a bit rough.
Yeah, right. So, so I went from a really easy 5-minute bike ride to a 20-minute car ride or an hour-long bike ride. And it's one of those things where I figured, okay, this is what I have to do to take the business to the next step. And it's the price you pay to grow. But
what changed for you immediately once you got to that shop, in terms of, like, you know, your shop now, it's a little cavernous, not like the stuff before, but you really had the space, and you really had the kind of a compound now.
Right.
Kind of yours.
Yeah.
And what, like, did you see things differently suddenly, or could you attack problems differently suddenly?
Well, having more room gave me the ability to buy more machinery, and that was great. Having more machinery means we can make more parts, and when we buy machinery, we buy modern machinery. I'd had two multi-axis lathes before, but we bought even more of the multi-axis machines, and they are just phenomenally productive machines. It takes longer to set them up, but once they're set up, the parts just come out finished. And literally, you take the parts out of the machine, either wash them or tumble them, and you ship them. There's no secondary operations. So they're very productive machines. So just having the physical space to cram more machines in there is really great. Now we're at the point where I really can't cram that many more machines in. And actually, what we've done just recently is I got rid of my oldest CNC lathe and my two oldest mills. And I'm replacing the lathe with another lathe, and the two mills I'm replacing with one mill, you know, much faster, much more productive mill. So we are keeping the machinery up to date to be able to continue with the production.
Percentage of your business now is bicycles? I know Salvesberg goes to you, and I know a few other people go to you. What percent of your business is strictly the bicycle frame stuff, right, and what is, you know, the other people around the area?
The job shop stuff. Yeah. I've never actually sat down and figured it out by monetary volume, but we have
about 80-20.
Okay.
80-20. We like those numbers.
Yeah, 80. So 80% bicycle and 20% job shop work. And the job shop work is good stuff. You know, when the economy tanked in 2007, 2008, the job shop stuff stopped dead. And the bike stuff carried us through. And that was one.
That's interesting. That exotic bicycle stuff was the work, and the meat and potatoes wasn't.
Right. Well, I think if someone has enough money to buy a $10,000 bike, economic downturns don't affect them as much as they do us little people.
That's probably true.
So people with money tend to have money no matter what's going on. So again, that's one of those things where it's really good that that our customers, you know, globally in the hand-built business, can afford this exotic stuff, because it is expensive. You know,
what are some of your favorite customers from the job shop side? Like, what kind of work do you do that you like, or who do you work for that you like outside of bicycle industry?
Yeah, well, one company makes winemaking equipment, and that was kind of interesting. A bunch of the people that used to work at Ibis Cycles went off to work for this wine equipment company in Healdsburg. So we do a lot of stuff out of stainless steel for them. It's process equipment. It's valve bodies, it's manifolds, it's crusher shafts. I mean, all kinds of hardware for turning grapes into wine.
If Chevron came to you and wanted a bunch of work done, would you switch that 80-20 the other direction and say, I'll take some Chevron work, thank you?
I would take the Chevron work, but we would not stop doing the bicycle stuff. I have never dealt with Chevron, but I imagine they've got their supply chains pretty well figured out.
Well, I just figured if they were going to add you to it, suddenly you were going to be a wealthy man.
As you mentioned, I'm a hardworking guy, and machine work is hard work. You have to work at it.
It never gets easy.
Yeah, and a company like Chevron is going to ask for quotes, and they are really probably going to be looking at the bottom line. And one of the things we can do with the bicycle stuff is, it's not that I want to overcharge or gouge anyone, but we get to set our own prices. We aren't in competition with another shop on making this stuff. And we do our best to price our stuff fairly and competitively. But
and you build your value on your reputation and the
right.
quality of your product.
Yeah. So the bike stuff, we're much more in control of what we do with it than the job shop stuff. And the job shop stuff by its nature is very competitive because there's machine shops everywhere, and any machine shop can make stuff. I mean, some are better than others, and some specialize in some stuff. But running a CNC mill or a lathe, I mean, they're designed to make anything.
We're going to talk a little bit about the parts, the design, and things that go into that. Right. But first, one thing I wanted to talk about, because we've led into all this and mm-hmm. we're going to cross through it, is employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, you've hired, or people have worked for you, mm-hmm. a lot of people mm-hmm. over
yeah.
the years.
Right. Oh, yeah.
A lot of people that went on to do their own things, great right. things, or maybe just didn't even, they didn't go anywhere,
right.
but
yeah.
whatever. There's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And whenever I go in the shop, there's always some new faces. Mm-hmm. There's people that are trying to do different things, mm-hmm. even while they're working for you.
Yeah.
And can you talk about your employees, or maybe some special cases, or just, you know, the relationship that you have with your employees? Because I'm sure
yeah.
you're a tough boss.
Yeah.
You know, and you know they're gonna have to put up with, I'm sure, the what makes you a tough boss. But
yeah.
but there's something there that keeps the magic happening.
Yeah, well, and you know, touching on the tough boss thing, one of the things that I will always tell all the employees that we make a product here that really is a premium product, and it's got to be right. We can't sell people junk. We can't sell people stuff that looks poor, stuff like that. So that's one of my toughest things. Like this stuff, if we're gonna put all this time and energy into it, let's make it right. And that's the one lesson that I would like everyone working for me to really understand. And I think all of them do. You know, at first they may not necessarily get it. They may be a little sloppy.
Because you hire some people that may lack
any
shop experiences.
Right, exactly.
And then when they come out, they've really been exposed to
yeah.
some real stuff.
Yeah. And employees are like any cross section of people. There are some outstanding, fantastic people, and there are some duds in there too. And you know, we do our best to weed the duds out. And the guys that are there typically tend to be long-term guys. You know, we've got a couple guys working for me who've been there over 10 years. And then some newbies who are just starting. But the employees, I mean, I obviously couldn't do all this stuff alone. So the employees are another one of our assets that allow us to do what we do. And they're a very valuable asset.
Cool. Okay, let's start talking about how, like you were talking about the art classes and
right.
you started into what it looks like and all that. Let's
yeah.
talk about, before we talk about specific things on your mm-hmm. table, sort of how you started looking at design
mm-hmm.
and thinking about what you drew.
Okay.
But then also technically how you drew it mm-hmm. and what kind of changes you've gone through
mm-hmm.
over the years.
Okay.
And sort of some philosophies that you may have
okay.
passed through over the years.
All right. Well, okay. So one really easy design philosophy that you can do with CNC, you can't do with anything else. The machine doesn't care if you do a straight line or a curve. So make a curve. You know, it almost always looks better. So that's a pretty simple design philosophy there. But curves have got just this really natural kind of flowing, beautiful look to them.
So you'll usually like to throw in a curve versus a straight line.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So you know, I mentioned earlier we're connecting the dots. Okay, you can connect the dots with a straight line, and it's gonna be perfectly functional. Or if you can find a curve that fits in there, that looks nice, and you know gives the bike frame some flow. That's a, you know, it doesn't cost any more, so you may as well do it. And that's a, you know, that's really one of the number one design philosophies.
Yeah, as someone who's designed and worked with CNC, you know, it seems like the enemy is the setup. Outside of that, yeah. You know, maybe too many tool changes, but it other than that, do whatever you want.
Yeah, right. Well, and what you said about setup, I think, is really important because we're designing our parts, we can design them to be as manufacturable as possible. So there's another challenge, is to get not only a good-looking part, but a part that is actually manufacturable. And not only manufacturable, but to do it economically.
When I talk about Mark Norstad and his products, that is exactly what I tell people.
Okay.
I tell him that he's designing a part to make, mm-hmm. and to make it look good.
Yeah, and that's it, exactly. That is what drives the design at Paragon Machine Works, is, it's got to look good, it's got to work, and...
But primarily, you're gonna shape a lot of that design around the process for you to make it economically and easier.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. And as we touched on before, the machines can make anything, but can they make it economically? And that's we talked about frames being expensive, you know, and we could have a 4-hour cycle time to make a pair of dropouts, but it's going to be so expensive, no one's going to buy it. You know, so we want to get that.
The problem is now we're entering into a marketplace where there are places for that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things, you know, bicycles are used by a lot of people for different purposes. But one of the huge things is bicycles are a hobby to many, many people. And what I found, as soon as people are involved in a hobby, there is no limit to the amount of money they'll spend. And that's one of the, so some of our stuff is, it goes off on the exotic kind of weird end. You know, our toggle drops are really, you know, kind of strange, odd dropouts, but they really function and they work well. But they're also very expensive. They are not for everyone.
Sure. Okay, over the years, because you've been involved for so long, you've gone from paper to digital, and having you do most of the work, and now you have other people. Can you talk some about that in terms of, like, your process, what you did and how it's changed over the years?
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, the...
Because I think I came to you one time with a job shop type thing I wanted to do, and you hated me for the 3D files.
Right, yeah.
And now everything's 3D.
Well, yeah.
Or whatever,
yeah,
but, like, and you were using, I think, a proprietary thing you had made or something,
it's
you.
It's a really common software. It's called PowerStation, and it's this really simple 2D software. And anything made on a lathe or a mill... I try and reduce it as much as possible to 2D things, because they're easier to manufacture and therefore they're less expensive.
You get tool paths and tool paths, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. But it did start out when I first started programming CNC machines. There were no personal computers out there. If you wanted a computer, it was a mainframe and it cost you a lot of money. So we would do programming with a paper and pencil and using trig tables and square root charts, because a four function calculator cost a week's wages. So finally, the shop I was working at bought a four-function calculator, and three of us shared it because it was really expensive. Yeah. So it was done on paper and pencil, and you did the trig to find the points for your cutter path. And eventually, I was able to buy a scientific calculator, and that was great. It would do all the trig functions for me. So that was really great. But things literally were laid out on a piece of paper, and you'd figure out what your cutter path would be. The first software I got was PowerStation, like I said, and that was a 2D software. And that all of a sudden opened up a lot of possibilities. Things that programming projects that would literally take days could be done in a matter of minutes.
Minutes because you were getting data to input, or you could feed it directly into the computer, into the machine?
Well, sort of both. Yeah. You know, The ability to design parts using the mathematical processing of the computer was very fast, and then the computer was a library, it was a storage mechanism for the programs that we run. So by wiring the CNC machine to the computer, now you can access your library and just load stuff into the CNC machine. So the speed of programming changed a lot. You know, it was much, much simpler. And I personally got stuck in the 2D world probably for far longer than I should have.
But you're busy being captain of a ship on rough waters.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah. You know, and there's a lot of things I would like to do, but I don't always have time to do it. And the 3D software that I have been using, you know, I'm either going to sound like a complete Luddite here, or this is an observation that's going to change the way 3D software works. 3D software, no matter how good your 3D CAD file is, to do it on a CNC machine, it always gets reduced to a 2D path. So you start with a 2D shape, you extrude it, you manipulate it, you do what you want, you put it in the computer, you reduce it to a 2D shape and run it in the CNC machine. So what do you start with? 2D shapes. What do you end up with? 2D shapes. You know, so there's a lot of stuff that happens in the middle. It's very valuable. It's very valuable for proving your design, very valuable to make your design, but from the machining standpoint, it doesn't have as much value because the process of machining,
this lends itself to your design philosophy,
right.
Of you're looking for designs that are manufacturable,
that are manufacturable,
and all that
stuff, exactly.
Versus the design that's the design and that's the design.
Right, exactly. And it's possible to have, you know, just a complete amoeba, amorphic kind of a shape, and you can machine that. Now, it's entirely doable, but again, it's not doable economically.
Right.
And so that's...
You have to get that part cost down enough so that bike people can afford it.
Exactly. And those sort of, really amorphic 3D shapes are great if you're... If you're building something that interfaces with, say, a human hand, you know, like an ergonomic
biomechanical
stuff, you know, or just a dashboard in a car. It's got a lot of
aerodynamics,
that kind of stuff. It's got some complex geometry, and in the matter of aerodynamics, it's driven by very very valid design concerns. But when you're cutting a shape out of a piece of quarter inch plate. You know, bottom line, it's a 2D shape.
You know, I like step chamfers and things like that,
right,
because
yeah.
I know that you're going to use a chamfer mill.
Right.
And
yeah.
It just
yeah.
makes it so you go around and you get some 3D, you get profiling without the pain and time of profiling.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's so many things you can do on the machine that sort of things that machinists know about and designers don't necessarily know about. And it's things like putting the chamfer on. And one of the things that we can do to speed up the process is put a chamfer on the front side of the dropout where it shows and don't chamfer the backside. You know, so it's a little cosmetic thing, but it literally cuts the cycle time in half if you don't have to turn the part over. You know, so it's a much more economical part. You know, it doesn't look as super fancy and nice, but again, do you need it? You know, and there are places where it pays off to chamfer both sides and to do work on both sides of the dropout. And of course, on any 12 millimeter dropout, there's a pocket on the back. Okay, so now you're forced into working in both sides. So if you work on both sides, then you may as well go ahead and put a chamfer on the back side.
Right. Yeah. But, feed the wheel in.
Yeah.
And all.
Right. Yeah. So.
So you're when you're talking about that, you're using SolidWorks at for design.
Yeah. We're using SolidWorks.
And what are you using for CAM?
We're using MasterCAM.
So you're using pretty much industry standards stuff.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, maybe not super duper industry standard, but stuff everybody knows and uses.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Yeah. And we have played around with Fusion 360. And like I said, for my personal design style, that process of going from 2D to 3D back to 2D is cumbersome. And I would like to have the option to be able to generate tool paths from directly from 3D shapes and not to have to reduce them down to 2D. And it's probably out there. I mean, it has to have been done. I just haven't figured it out yet.
I think there's a lot of progress that can be made in the transition between your CAD environment and your CAM environment.
Right. Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah.
I think Fusion 360 is a start for that, but it's got its own little animals, and I think it's addressing a little bit more the needs of the small maker that isn't caring about their data, and versus someone like you that your data is your data, or you're working really industrially, you want some powerful stuff.
Well, and Fusion 360 is the complete thing. You know, you can render it all, you can, you know, you can do some design analysis in there, and that stuff, you know, doesn't do anything for me.
So you've had, because you're a fairly large operation, considering what you're doing, you've given up some of this design and engineering up to certain people to help you with that. What is that like? Because, I mean, you're not going to take Norstad out of these parts.
Right.
But these people have to work, and they have to generate, they have to create, but in your way, and they have to do it acceptably, and you kind of, you can't always beat them up. You have to give them a little bit of room.
Yeah.
And how do you work now in terms of design? How do they work, and how do you sort of balance the between the two?
Well, we'll first sit down with a paper and pencil and just sketch.
Kind of have an engineering meeting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I never thought of it like
or
that.
Design meeting.
We talk about how things are going to look or what we're going to do. So, you know, they're the parameters that we have to meet. It's got to hold a wheel. It's got to hold a brake. It's got to do, you know, whatever else, rack eyelets or whatever the design concerns are. So we sort of rough that out, and then we'll start saying, okay, so what's this thing going to look like? You know, what's the material we're going to start with, and what's the process going to be? Are we going to start on this side of it or the other side, or is there something else like on a post mount? The first thing we do is put the 2 6-millimeter holes in a block of aluminum.
So right away in your design, just within your system, you're building the making of it right into the design, right from the birth.
Absolutely from the start. Absolutely, okay. Yeah. And then once we sort of have the concept roughed out, then it goes on the computer. And again, it starts with a 2D sketch, and then we'll turn it into a 3D representation of what we're trying to make. And that's a valuable step, because if it looks right in a 3D representation, it's going to look right as the 3D genuine part.
I tell students that all the time. Get it right in the computer. Just like the photographers, get it right in the camera.
Yeah.
It's like, get it right in the computer, because if you're not willing to put the time in at the computer, why are you even going to be cutting metal? Because, it's pennies on the dollar, and you can validate.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll sort of validate it, and then it goes back to sort of, you know, things are going to change somewhat as it goes into this 3D representation, either to make it look better or to function better or something like that. And then we kind of review what our manufacturing strategy is going to be. You know, how big is the material, and what's our first operation, our second operation, our third operation. And that's all designed in right from the beginning. And then once we sort of make that decision, then it's getting tool passed. And we use software to generate the tool paths. And the other big thing that is really overlooked a lot is, how do you hang on to this stuff? You know, if you have a dropout that's...
Just work holding issues.
Yeah, if you have anything that you want to cut a profile around the outside of it, well, that means you can't clamp it from the outside. You've got to figure out some other way to clamp it down. So we spend a lot of time figuring out how things are going to get held. Very often there'll be some feature machined in as a locating feature, that by the time we get to the last operation, that's machined off, and no one ever sees that. But that's part of the design process and the manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm. Let's say maybe look at something that you'd like to talk about that you're showing here, and kind of, you know, maybe things that kind of push you, they challenge you from whatever level, and that you'd just kind of like to mention some things about.
There's sort of... you know, we're looking at a bunch of dropouts that we've designed and manufactured, some of them from very simple to more complex. You know, some of the things like, you know, well, let's go over here. The sliding dropout. This has been around for over 10 years now. When we first made these...
It's probably considered the standard sliding dropout.
Right, yeah.
Everybody copies it directly.
Right, exactly,
almost.
Yeah. And the dimensions of the slot, 9 millimeters by 9 millimeters, that's turned into an industry standard. All the copies all use 9 by 9 millimeters, which, you know, that's sort of an interesting thing. When I designed this, I had no idea that I was designing an industry standard. I was designing something that I thought was going to be functional.
I think that's how industry standards most often work.
Right, yeah. so the I had people asking me about a sliding dropout, and at the point I thought, well, you know, there's not enough market for it. It's pretty esoteric. It was designed for single speeds with a disc brake, and the advantage of a sliding dropout.
But that was like right as the single speed boom was happening.
Right. But disc brakes weren't as common as they are now. So okay. It was, you know, when people built a single speed, they took their old mountain bike. And they stripped the cassette off it, and they
put a track drop on it
or something like that. You know, so it was kind of a hack job. And disc brakes were much more expensive then, and people didn't want to put a disc brake on their single speed because it was too expensive. So from an engineering
or problem solving point of view, a sliding situation like when you're traditionally thinking of like a track dropout and grabbing it at the hub type of thing.
Right.
It's, you know, we've seen all the cobbled Rube Goldberg type ways of dealing with that, and it's brutal. And, you know, this simplifies it.
Right.
Once you get to discs, suddenly this is the best.
This only makes sense if you have a disc brake. So as disc brakes became more popular, this gives you the ability when you adjust tension your chain, your brake caliper moves with the wheel as an assembly. And when I first made these, I bought one length of material, and I think it made about 40 pairs of dropouts. And I thought, that's it. I've just made the entire world's supply of sliding dropouts, and I'm done. I don't never have to make these things again.
I'm actually going to be buying a set of these hooded steel dropouts. Like, that's one of them on my list right now.
Okay. But anyways, you know, so it was one of those things that, you know, I didn't see the potential in this. And it was one of those things that enough people bugged me and said, why don't you make this? And I said, okay, you know, fine, I'm going to shut you up, and I'm going to make a few of these, and then I'm going to be done with it. And
isn't that the way to get results out of you?
Right,
just everyone keep whining to Mark?
Me, right, yeah. So, you know, so we went ahead and made them. And again, this is one of these sort of happy accidents that happened. So it was meant for a single speed and a disc brake application. Well, now all of a sudden you have the ability to change the wheelbase on your bike. You have the ability to change the inserts if you want to run a post mount or an ISO mount, if you want to run a derailleur or not a derailleur, and it effectively functions as a modular dropout.
Were you looking at the Kavik stuff around that time?
No, not aware of that.
Okay, Kavik was doing modular type of things in that era. Probably, I don't know if he was copying somebody, but it's kind of who I reference when I think modular in the rear. But this, I mean, I guess the slider dropout ended up being the modular dropout.
Right, yeah. And speaking of other people doing this, I got to put in a word here. The design, it was not entirely mine to start with. The guy named Eric Barr, who does Ground Up Speed Shop, and he was in Colorado. I had no idea who he was. I never met him. And some builder in Colorado.
Hopefully he'll be here today.
Oh, yeah. No, Eric and I are
we? No, I mean, he broke down on the way here.
Yeah, I saw him this morning.
Oh, rad. Cool. I'm going to interview him today.
Yeah, okay, good. Anyway, so one of the things that happened, so this other builder from Colorado was saying, you know, we want a slider dropout. And I said, well, you know, I don't have time to design it. You know, I don't want to, you know, I don't think there's much of a market for it. He said, well, let me send you a sample pair to kind of kickstart it. And he sent me a pair of Eric Barr's dropouts. And one of the questions was, well, who made these? Am I poaching on someone's territory? And he said, no, don't worry about it. It's okay. Just go ahead and make them. So Eric's design, I think, used a 6-millimeter clamp bolt instead of an 8-millimeter. And I felt that was a little bit undersized, so which is why I went to an 8-millimeter bolt. And I think he had a little bit thinner dropout. And basically, I took Eric Barr's design and just beefed it up.
And you also have a really good understanding of what's needed structurally from a bicycle component.
Yeah,
you have more experience than anybody, pretty much.
Yeah, but and again, it's all empirical, you know. But I've been around bikes long enough.
That's where, knowledge,
yeah,
right?
It is knowledge, right? Exactly. So got to give credit where credit's due. Eric Barr is the guy who sort of inspired this design. Before Eric, I know that that Roloff had a sliding dropout, which I was not aware of at the time either. It wasn't until after I made these that someone said, oh, that looks like the Roloff one, you know. So none of this stuff comes, I mean, going off on another tangent here, but none of this stuff comes out of a vacuum. You know, other people have done this stuff. And
as I've said before, the smartest minds in the world have worked on this stuff for the past 150 years.
Right. And and it comes down, I mean, one of the things I've always been able to do is actually manufacture this stuff. You know, Eric is a bright guy, and he came up with a really nice design, but he didn't have the resources to do the manufacturing. He didn't have the resources to do the sales, and, you know, no one knew about him. And at the time, people actually knew about Paragon Machine Works. So those are some competitive advantages that I've had over other people. But getting back to the design work, you know, it's evolved, and that's one of the beautiful things about it being a modular dropout. You know, there's no one did post mounts when this thing came out. You know, it was ISO mount only, and then it's one of those things. Well, can you make it a post mount? Yeah,
sure. I'm glad to see you're offering a 140 now too for the post mount.
Oh yeah, yeah, we got that.
That's
too.
That's a nice change. Uh-huh. I'm gonna get some.
Yeah, 140, 160, and then above that you got to do an adapter, but that's fine. But anyway, the design is a. You know, it's dynamic. As the bicycle evolves, these designs evolve as well. And this is part of the evolution of the bicycle.
And then you go into the, you know, as we know from a solution finding thing, we turned into the what are they called, the toggle style? I'm not toggle,
yeah,
but
the rocker drop.
The rocker
was
style.
Kind of next up, and the rocker drop.
Wasn't that what's her name? Black Cat or somebody else?
Yeah. Again, credit where credit's due. This is Todd Ingermanson of Black Cat Bicycles. He had a rocker style dropout, and it was one of those things where I was like, okay, here's, you know, Todd came up with this, and I don't know what Todd's inspiration was. But a really clever design, and it was nicely made, and everyone was bugging me. He's like, why don't you make a dropout? Why don't you make a rocker-style dropout? And it's like, well, Todd's already done that. Go buy it from Todd.
Sure.
And eventually got to the point where Todd couldn't keep up. You know, Todd's a frame builder. He's not a manufacturer. And so one of the conversations I had with Todd is like, I don't want to poach on your territory, but I'm getting...
You can keep up.
I'm getting bowled over by these requests. Right. And he said, go for it.
Yeah.
You know,
okay,
so based on that, you know, I did a couple little adjustments on the rocker design. One of the big changes that I made was putting the brake mount as a low mount, essentially on the chainstay. And what that did was it freed up the back of the dropout for rack or fender eyelets, which turned out to be a really good thing because
I personally like a rear mounted caliper, but yeah. I do understand that if you're doing racks and fenders, you need that space.
Yeah, there's you got to put it somewhere, right? So, and what that has done is, you know, the whole roll-off thing was taking off at the same time, or internally geared hubs, the Shimano Alfine, and those are excellent hubs for commuter-style bikes. And a commuter bike is almost always going to have fenders, it's always going to have a rack, and it really addresses that market really well.
Sure, yeah. How about, what's a design that you pulled your hair out on? I mean, I'm sure the toggle drop probably strikes you somewhere, but is there something that just kind of, it might even look simple, but something that in your mind go, oh, you mother.
Well, yeah, and it's right here. This is the flat mount, and this is one of those things where there's a demand for the flat mount, and it's like, okay, people need this now. People have to get this thing done on their bike. So it's like, okay, what can we do?
This is something where carbon production really led this type of mount.
Right, exactly. And this mount, when you really sort of understand what the design criteria is, this is a mount that was designed for carbon fiber bikes.
Absolutely.
And when it gets
And aesthetic bikes.
Yeah. And when it gets reverse engineered into metals, there's a lot of challenges that aren't there when you're doing it in carbon fiber. When you're doing it in a mold, you know, you can do a lot of machine work in a mold. And then after that, once the mold is done, it's relatively easy to produce your parts. So this is one of those things where it's like, well, how do we put all this stuff together and make it fit and make it look good and do it
and make it so a frame builder gets it.
And make it so a frame builder can do it. And a couple things, I mean, the actual mount is self-locating. Okay. So it locates on the inside face of the dropout, the top edge of the dropout, and there's a stop on the back. So you just slide that on and you can TIG weld it or silver it on. So no fixture or jig is needed to put the actual brake mount on. So that was one of those things that, you know, I was really happy we were able to do that. But one of the things, the sort of aesthetics of it, I think, are lacking. And I think there's some room for improvement on this. The sort of posts that hold the brake up are just kind of clunky looking.
I can honestly say, having looked at this deeply and designed parts like it, is a very challenging problem.
It is. And this one, so what we have here is a perfectly functional part. It works great. It you know, of all the design elements for functionality, it fulfills everything you want. But from how the whole thing looks, like I say, there's room for some improvement, and that's one of the things that I would like to be able to take the time and sit down and figure out an improved version of this.
Okay, you've been around a long time. You've talked with pretty much every frame builder in existence, or you've seen them, or seen their stuff, or anything like that. You're taking a look around. What what do you see happening with, I don't know, I'm thinking of younger builders and people that get drawn in by the flash and the fancy stuff,
right?
And then they start realizing slowly that the real meat and potatoes and the hardest part is the stuff that nobody sees,
right?
And you can't cover up with paint.
Right.
And what would you say to people like that in terms of kind of getting their head around what is all this, even if it doesn't even turn into a bike thing, but it kind of informs their life in terms of like, yeah, there's lots of sparkles over there, but you know, you still kind of have to get your nose into the grindstone.
Yeah, and the thing I'd want to say to any of those guys is be prepared for a lot of work. It's just an incredible amount of work. Not only actually physically building the frame, but now you got to deal with customers. You got to find customers. You got to make sure your customers pay you. If you're seriously running a business, you've got income tax and sales tax to deal with. You've got to have a shop space, and the shop space has got to conform to your local regulations. So that's just that whole end of it. And then if you want to promote your business, you've got to come to a show like this, and that involves paying for your booth space.
Well, you go to more shows than this. You go to lots of stuff.
Just two other ones. We do, well, let me see. We do the.
I feel like I see you everywhere.
Well, we do the Philly show. We do this show, and we do a local show, Biketoberfest, which is just purely a social event.
That's where you old-timers get to hang out.
Old-timers hang out. But anyway, so besides just, you know, physically having a shop and building your bike, then to promote it, you've got to, you know, either advertise, you know, on a, you know, some sort of electronic forum or print forum. You got to get your name out there. You've got to get recognized. If you want to be in a magazine, you got to buy advertising in the magazine before the magazine looks at your stuff. You know, it's not, you know, no one will say if you buy advertising, we're going to give you an interview. But after you've been buying advertising for a year or two, guess what? They come and they interview you. You know, so it's you.
The world works in certain ways.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, and a lot of it is not explicitly written out for the frame builder. So it's a real learning experience. There's a lot more to it than simply building a frame. And if anyone's going to do stuff like that, do the research. You know, find out what it takes to actually do it. Inquire at some of the frame building schools. There's a bunch of good ones out there. Those are a great resource. And you may look at it and say, well, that's an awful lot of money to go to a frame building school. But the value of that will pay off every single day you're in business in knowing what the processes are to get through this. And the good frame building schools will address the business side of it, the regulatory side of it. Now, you want to paint your bikes, there's a lot of regulations going with it.
Safety.
And safety, too. Yeah, you got to have insurance, you know, that kind of stuff.
So you have to not kill yourself.
Not kill yourself. Well, that's a good start, yeah. you know, and the thing is, When young frame builders start, they're really enthusiastic, which is great. You know, that's a good way to be. And they are so enthusiastic, they are willing to work essentially for nothing. They'll tell all their friends and family, I'll build you a frame if you just pay for the materials. Okay, so it's a great way to start, and it's a great way to get your stuff out there, and it's a great way to learn your craft. But at some point, you got to make the transition and not sell to your friends and family. You're going to have to find a customer. And it's a really competitive field. I mean, if you look around this hall, there are so many talented guys with such outstanding products.
And every niche is very saturated.
Every niche is saturated. So that's your competition. So if you're a young frame builder and you wanted to get into this, you know, I mean, these builders here are sort of, they represent the higher end of American frame building and international frame building. But the thing to do would be to come to a show like this and look at what's out there and ask yourself, can I work at this level? And if you answer the question no, maybe...
Yeah, you're going to have a hard time selling a bike.
You're going to have a hard time, yeah, because a lot of these guys have been doing it for a long time. They make beautiful stuff.
You got to match at least their everyday level.
You got to match at least their stuff, exactly.
This interview, obviously, very in-depth, not the typical magazine interview.
Right.
Who would you recommend, without stepping on toes, that I do the next interview with?
Oh, gosh.
Somebody who's going to give me some crazy tech design stuff. or whatever.
Talked to Paul Brody yet?
Of course.
Okay. All right. So
he was tough.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just different mannerisms.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah. Steve Potts.
I did Steve. Okay. Oh, he sat me down.
Okay. Kent Erickson.
I did Kent Erickson and I did Brett. Is it Brett?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me see. Well, that's it. You know, as you say, got Ron Andrews.
I'm going to do Ron.
Okay, right,
I'm going to convince him to do it.
Yeah, no, Ron.
I want him to tell us stories.
No, he's the best storyteller. you know, I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough
okay,
one.
Okay, I'll make sure. Yeah. I'll say, Ron, you got to do it because Mark said so.
I said so, yeah. And play this interview back to him. So let's see. Gosh. Yeah, there's so many people here. It's tough to...
That's great, Mark. I really appreciate the time you put in and the great work you've done.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.